Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now to excerpts from and reactions to the second Democratic presidential hopefuls debate last night. It was held in New Hampshire, still the first primary state as of now, despite all the jockeying for position, and broadcast on CNN as well as WNYC AM 820. And we thank CNN for radio rights, and we will continue to air every presidential debate that we can get the rights to. Now, one of the themes last night was John Edwards going after Clinton and Obama for being too cautious and not leading enough on both domestic and foreign policy, according to Edwards. So let's start with one key exchange between Edwards and Senator Clinton. Moderator Wolf Blitzer asked about Edwards' statement recently that the war on terror is mostly just a bumper sticker.
That's exactly what it is. It's a bumper sticker. As President of the United States, I will do absolutely everything to find terrorists where they are, to stop them before they can do harm to us, before they can do harm to America or to its allies. Every tool available, military, alliances, intelligence, I will use. But what this global war on terror bumper sticker, political slogan, that's all it is, all it's ever been, was intended to do was for George Bush to use it to justify everything he does. The ongoing war in Iraq, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, spying on Americans, torture. None of those things are okay. They are not the United States of America.
Senator Clinton, you agree with Senator Edwards that this war on terror is nothing more than a bumper sticker, at least the way it's been described?
No, I do not. I am a senator from New York. I have lived with the aftermath of 9/11, and I have seen firsthand the terrible damage that can be inflicted on our country by a small band of terrorists who are intent upon foisting their way of life and using suicide bombers and suicidal people to carry out their agenda. And I believe we are safer than we were. We are not yet safe enough. And I have proposed over the last years a number of policies that I think we should be following.
So, Edwards and Clinton from last night's debate, give us your calls with anything you learned about the candidates or the issues. Watching or listening last night, 212-433-WNYC. Or if you didn't watch or listen, anything that you're gleaning from the news coverage, including these clips this morning, and we've got a lot more clips to play. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. And with me first to talk about it is Matt Bai, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. He writes frequently about Democratic Party politics, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics, coming out in August. Hi, Matt. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. How's it going?
It's going great. What did you make of that exchange to focus right in there?
Well, everybody, I mean, you know, it's hard to judge debates one by one, because what you see is sort of an emerging picture right over time of where all these candidates are going. They're all getting better. They're all honing their messages. And I think a little too much perhaps was made of that clash. I mean, everybody has an agenda here. All three of the frontrunners certainly are trying to do something specific on Iraq. But at the end of the day, if you listen to them, I don't know that this is the defining issue in a Democratic primary, because they're all going to be essentially for ending the war. I mean, they're all the disagreements are pretty minor. And, you know, the clash was, I guess, sharp in relation to what you've seen before.
But I thought on that clip they went past, and I purposely didn't choose the old, you know, Hillary didn't state her regrets for her past vote, or
Obama
saying, you know, Edwards didn't come out against the war 4.5 years ago like he did. But rather this, where they seem to have a difference in judgment about how effective the Bush administration has been in preventing additional terrorist attacks, which might have implications for what kind of president they would be. I mean, you know, Edwards talking about Bush linking this to Guantanamo and all that stuff positions him, I think, to the left of Clinton in terms of what promises he's making on civil liberties and things like that.
Well, what he's trying to do here is pretty clear. I'm not suggesting it's all a cynical calculation, but you know, Edwards was in the position of having done to him by Howard Dean 4 years ago what he's now trying to do to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, which is when you're not there and you don't have to cast some of these votes that are coming up now and you don't have to take a strong position, it's a whole lot easier when you're not bound by the party loyalty and the strategy the party's pursuing in the Senate, et cetera, to come out and criticize. And so, you know, he's really doing to them what Dean did to him, which is essentially to go after them for votes and their lack of leadership, what he calls their lack of leadership in the Senate, because he doesn't have to deal with the same pressures. I was surprised to hear Senator Clinton say that we are safer than we were before. And I'm not, to be honest with you, watching it, I'm not entirely sure that she meant to say that or meant to say it as definitively or in the context that she did. She essentially did credit the Bush administration and what it had done for making the country safer than it was before September 11th. A lot of core Democrats would disagree strongly with that statement, and I would be surprised, or I'd be interested to know if she's going to use that wording again.
Well, maybe others will follow up with her on that today. Let's play another clip from the debate. Same basic theme. Again, John Edwards going after the other front runners, this time specifically Senator Obama, on the issue of universal health care. Now, Edwards says his plan is truly universal and requires everyone to get coverage. Obama had just admitted his plan would not cover everyone.
I think Senator Obama was very honest just now. We have a threshold question about whether we're going to have truly universal care. The New Republic has estimated that his plan will leave about 15 million people uncovered. He says he will do something about that later. I believe unless we have a law requiring that every man, woman, and child in America be covered, we're going to have millions of people who aren't covered. Right. Secondly, all the savings that Senator Clinton just talked about are in my plan, and they're in Senator Obama's plan. Right. And both of us have recognized that it's going to cost significant money, and we've talked about how we're going to pay for it.
Well, Senator Obama, since John referred to me, I agree with him on the second point, which is we've got these savings, and we're still going to have to do a little bit more, partly because you've got to invest up front in, for example, information technology so that rural hospitals that don't have computers are able to buy them, and they're going to need some help. But on this issue of mandatory versus non-mandatory, I'm not going around trying to avoid buying health care coverage. And, in fact, if you look at auto insurance, in California, there's mandatory auto insurance. 25% of the folks don't have it. The reason is because they can't afford it. So, John and I, we're not that different in this sense, that I'm committed to starting the process. Everybody who wants it can buy it, and it's affordable. If we have some gaps remaining, we will work on that. You take it from the opposite direction, but you're still going to have some folks who aren't insured under your plan, John, because some of them will simply not be able to afford to buy the coverage that they are offering.
Children cannot make that decision.
Well, and that's why I've got mandatory.
The decision he's talking about people making cannot be made by children. And that's why you have to require that they be covered.
John, I've got mandatory insurance for children.
Just 30 seconds.
For that reason.
Hold on one second. I promise Congressman Kucinich.
I reject this whole approach, and the American people should know that with half the bankruptcies in the country connected to people not being able to pay their doctor bills or hospital bills, premiums, co-pays, and deductibles going so far through the roof, 46 million Americans, no health care, another 50 million underinsured, there is only one way to get health care coverage for all Americans, and that is to have a universal, single-payer, not-for-profit health care system, Medicare for all. Wolf, I've written the bill. It's H.R. 676 with John Conyers, supported by 14,000 physicians. And you know what? What Senator Clinton, Senator Edwards, Senator Obama are talking about? They're talking about letting the insurance companies stay in charge. They're talking about continuing a for-profit health care system. And I think we need a president who's ready to challenge that. And I'm ready to challenge the insurance companies.
So about a 2.5-minute excerpt from the debate last night, Obama, Edwards, and Kucinich, with Wolf Blitzer on CNN, and we're talking about it with Matt Bye, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and author of the forthcoming book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics, and we'll get to your phone calls in just a minute. Now, that was interesting to me, Matt, because that was extremely substantive on specific issues of whether coverage should be mandatory for individuals, whether individuals who can't afford to buy health insurance ever decline on, you know, the complete universality of one plan versus the other. And, of course, Kucinich in there rejecting the so-called front-runner's approach and saying, hey, why are we letting the insurance companies have a role in this at all? So if nothing else, Americans who watched that last night had a bit of a substantive debate on health care.
They did, Brian, although I'm gonna take a slightly different tack on it, I think. You know, they did if they could follow that debate, and that debate revolves around, as you say, some important substantive points, but probably that at the end of the day are not going to be determinative as to whether we get, you know, a comprehensive health care plan or not. I mean, Senator Obama's right. He doesn't require a mandate, and that could have some cost issues, but it's not, you know, he's still going to cover very close to universal coverage under his plan. Senator Edwards has the most expansive and sort of the boldest plan, which I write about actually in the Sunday's magazine, the one coming up.
And in fact, so I wonder what you think then about
right.
Paul Krugman's column today, if you happen to see it.
I'm not.
Where he focused in on that exchange, and he said what you see in these two plans
right.
is an indication of the character with which Edwards and Obama might each govern, and that Obama is campaigning as being more cautious, and
right.
therefore he is likely to be a little more cautious when elected than Edwards, who is putting it way out there on all this stuff. And so since he's willing to do that, unless you call it pure, you know, posturing for the sake of political advantage for the moment, that he's showing something about his character and being willing to swing wide. And if he's elected, that would be reflected likely in his presidency.
Let me just finish my point here, if I can.
Sure.
Because Paul may be right about that. You know, I think it's too early. I don't think they've quite found their campaigning voices enough to know. And I think that the relative boldness he's talking about on Senator Edwards' plan is there, but not hugely different. I, what interested me about this, and it goes to the health care issue, but it goes to the larger issue in the debate, all the issues, which is that I think in the entire 2 hours, I've not seen a transcript, but from my just watching it in the entire 2 hours, I don't think the words 21st century came up once. I don't think the discussion ever went beyond either what was done in the last 5 years on Iraq, where the vote was 4.5 years ago, what's been going on in the Senate in the last 6 months, or what you're going to do in the next 3 or 4 years if you get elected about health care. And this is an important discussion, the health care discussion. But what none of these candidates are doing to this point, what the Democratic Party as a whole has struggled to do, is to explain to its own voters and to voters across the country what's changing in the country on a larger scale, what's changed about the economy, what does globalization mean, why is healthcare so much a bigger issue than it was 10 or 20 years ago, why it's important over the next 30 or 40 years to our competitiveness and to the health of the American citizenry that we figure out how to solve this problem. There is very little big, long-range thinking, and I think it's really significant that nobody talked about sort of the huge fundamental shifts that are going on from one century to the next, that nobody talked about sort of how to rethink some of these issues, how to think differently about how government needs to work. These are very small board debates. So I would agree with you that there were some significant substantive differences, and maybe Paul Krugman is right that those substantive differences would highlight larger governing philosophies in office. I'm not sure you could back that up historically. But at the end of the day, I think what's missing from this discussion was any of the larger narrative or arguments you mm-hmm. have to make to voters in order to show that you really understand the moment and can help them understand the moment.
Let's take some listener reaction to the debate. Kevin in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
So I missed all of the stand-up portion of the debate.
Uh-huh.
But in the sit-down portion, I was surprised by how much...
And by the way, for people who don't know what that means, the first half, the first hour, was done, like most of these debates you see on TV, with Wolf Blitzer and a couple of other reporters asking questions of the candidates who were all standing at podiums. Then in the second half, the candidates came and sat on chairs toward the front of the stage, and undecided voters from New Hampshire asked them their questions. So that was the sit-down portion. Kevin, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. And I did really like the way they handled that, and I thought Wolf Blitzer did as well as he could in that situation. I was surprised with how much I came away liking Hillary after that. Thought she was very authoritative, just cosmetically, which, you know, does matter in this game. She came across really well. She had a good sense of humor. I especially liked how she took control of the debate and said, listen, this hand-raising thing is not how we should be answering questions.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much. Paul, listening in Portland, Maine, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Thanks a lot for playing that clip, which included Kucinich's ideas on healthcare, which you know, I contend will have great ramifications in this 21st century. I just wanted to say also that your panelist there, you know, was saying they don't differ greatly on Iraq, and that is incredibly untrue. Kucinich, of course, voted not only against the initial resolution, but has voted against war funding 8 times now. And I have an analogy for this, for the country. If everyone else fails the test, and this is most likely the most important test for these candidates, if everyone else has failed a test in a school, you don't elevate one of the failures to valedictorian position, correct?
Referring, I get your point, and that's why you wouldn't elevate one of those, one of the senators. And Paul, thank you for your call. Now, Matt, before you go and we bring on another guest and play some more clips, since you have the book coming out, and I hereby invite you for a proper book interview when it does come out this summer.
Accepted. Thank you.
The argument, billionaires, bloggers, and the battle to remake democratic politics. In a sentence, does the theme of your book apply to what you saw last night on stage?
Yeah, it really does, or what I was just saying, that it doesn't apply. I mean, I think, or rather that it applies to what wasn't said on stage, is what I should say, which is that you do need to have an overarching argument for this upcoming century, for government in an entirely changed era where people really sense how profound those changes are. And what I've done in the book is to sort of chart, it's not my argument, but it charts the struggle of a lot of the people who are central to this new progressive movement that's so influential in the Democratic Party, to try to figure out what that argument's supposed to be. And I think as you watch these debates unfold, not just now but over the course of this campaign season, you're going to see that that struggle taking shape, and you may see someone emerge with the kind of large vision that Bill Clinton had in 1992.
Matt Bai, thanks a lot.
Anytime. Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. When we continue, Joe Biden and Bill Richardson disagreeing on Darfur, Hillary Clinton on English as an official language, and more of your calls, and Ruben Navarrete. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and a quick reminder to check out our online video picks. Every week we choose videos from the web, which I anchor in a picks video, and this week they do include a great roundup produced by Politics TV of the best web videos so far by or about the presidential candidates. So that's our online video picks at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Continuing with excerpts from the Democratic debate last night, Darfur came up toward the end of the debate, and it was interesting to hear a few different disagreements and particularly to hear the passion of Joe Biden on this issue. So we're going to play a clip of Biden and then Bill Richardson disagreeing with him on one of his proposals.
You know, we have to stop talking about it. A lot of talk goes on about it. The United Nations has already said they're prepared to put in a 21,000 force, including the African Union. In fact, you have in the capital of Sudan, the government saying, we're not going to allow that to happen. They have forfeited their sovereignty by engaging in genocide. We should impose a no-fly zone. If the UN will not move now, we should impose a no-fly zone, and we should commit 2,500 NATO troops. You could take out the Janjaweed tomorrow. I went there. I sat in the borders. I went in those camps. They're going to have thousands and thousands and thousands of people die. We got to stop talking and act. That's right. Why last Monday I went to see the President of the United Nations, as the General Assembly, as well as the Secretary General, to make that point.
Raise your hand if you agree with Senator Biden that the United States should use military force to stop the genocide in Darfur.
We're talking about a no-fly zone?
Hold on.
You start with the no-fly zone, but very often, Senator Clinton, that could move on to other operations.
We're not going to engage in these hypotheticals. I mean, one of the jobs of a president is being very reasoned in approaching these issues, and I don't think it's useful to be talking in these kind of abstract hypothetical terms.
I don't want to raise hands,
but I was I was there.
Governor, would you use force to save people in Darfur?
No. What I would do is, and I was there, I got a very fragile ceasefire put together 3 months ago, and we made things a little better. I went with a Save Darfur coalition. This is what I would do. Number one, more UN peacekeepers. The government is refusing to make this happen. Secondly, economic sanctions. We've imposed them, but they're weak. We need European countries to make them happen. Third, we need China to lean on China, which has enormous leverage over Darfur. And if the Chinese don't want to do this, we say to them, maybe we won't go to the Olympics. And lastly, what we need is a country, a foreign policy that cares about Africa, that cares that 300,000 human beings have died, have been massacred, that over 2 million have lost their homes. Gender-based violence, rape. America should care about Africa, and we don't.
All
right, about a 2.5-minute clip with the candidates there on Darfur from last night, and you heard the pandemonium in the middle of that. I don't think anybody really wanted an answer to have to raise their hand to answer Wolf's hypothetical. But you heard the disagreement among some of the candidates. And with us briefly now is Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Group. Ruben, I'm sorry that your time is getting squeezed here. It's because of the JFK alleged terror plot, which took up a lot more of our time this morning than we had anticipated on Friday before that was revealed. But what do you make of that exchange, and what did you make of the whole debate?
I thought the exchange was good, and I thought the whole debate provided a lot more elbows than previous exchanges, and we need more elbows, both with Republicans and Democrats. I mean that there needs to be more of an attempt to differentiate one candidate from the other, and I think that was something that happened last night in some regard. It's an interesting balance they strike. You know, on the one hand, they want to appear that the differences, as Hillary Clinton said, between themselves are really minor compared to the major differences between them and Bush and them and the Republicans. So I get that. On the other hand, they want to be able to differentiate themselves and, when necessary, punch the other guy in the nose. And so I want to see some more nose punching.
Interesting that Biden came out with a lot of fire on a few things. I guess this is maybe his last best chance to climb out of the second tier, if he's ever going to do it. Do you think that's what that was about?
I think that's what that was about. I think it was also a sense that this was a chance, as you said, to break through. I don't think he was successful, but only because the top three are still the top three. I think that Obama, Edwards, and Hillary dominated the night, and most of the exchange was really between the three of them. And I learned something last night. You know, these polls aren't made of whole cloth. They aren't just sort of, we create them out of thin air. The reason these three are the front runners in most polls, Edwards, Obama, and Clinton, is because they really do have something on the ball, and they showed it last night. So, you know, Biden and Dodd and Richardson are sort of in the tier that they are because they earned it, you know, and because the others are in the top tier because they earned that.
Well, then again, you have a self-perpetuating cycle, don't you? Because CNN did give those labeled top three much more airtime than the others and kept referring to them as the top tier candidates.
There's some of that. They're also, these candidates themselves were addressing each other. As, for instance, when Obama turned to Edwards and said, you know, John, you're 4.5 years late on leadership. And so for a while, you have to admit there was this conversation between the three of them, sort of left out the others. But the point is, you know, Biden and Dodd, they're grown-ups. They are where they are because of either what they project or the persona they've built over the years or the fundraising that they have. And, you know, I think that to the credit of Edwards and Clinton and Obama, they dominate forums like that.
One more clip from the senator from New York referring to New York on the question of English as an official language.
The problem is that if it becomes official instead of recognized as national, which indeed it is our national language. If it becomes official, that means in a place like New York City, you can't print ballots in any other language. That means you can't have government pay for translators in hospitals, so when somebody comes in with some sort of emergency, there's nobody there to help translate what their problem is for the doctors. So many of us, I did at least, voted to say that English was our national language, but not the official language because of the legal consequences.
Well, we have about 45 seconds left, Ruben. You were last here to talk about the immigration bill, which you support.
Right.
And
right.
Hillary Clinton was making the distinction there between an official
right.
language and a national language. What did you think of that distinction?
I think it's an important distinction for a lawyer to make. I understood it, and I applaud her for making the distinction, but most Americans don't think that way. They don't understand the difference between official language and national language. That national language is like the national bird, you know, the national symbol, the eagle or something. And official language means that you're going to have these ballots and bilingual education and the like is gone, and you've got all these things in English. So I applaud her for making the distinction. I though, deplore the question, and I applaud Obama for calling Wolf Blitzer on this stupid and divisive question. He says we're going to talk about immigration. Now let's ask a related question. Should English be the national language?
And Ruben,
this is the problem. When you start talking about immigration and you end up talking about language, you send a message that really the nativism of old is back again.
Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Group, thank you very much. Quick
thank
reminder,
you.
We will have the Republicans debate from New Hampshire tomorrow night at 9 on AM 820 WNYC.